This is Roni's Own Radio. Now, Roni's Own Radio is a show where we present views and interviews about everything from God to Star Wars and everything in between, in about 30 minutes. We hope to enlighten, enrage, and engage you by looking at topics from many different angles. You never know what you're going to get with Roni's Own Radio, but it will always be a very, very different podcast. Roni's Own Radio. Check us out at jrdonline.com. And now, on with the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Roni's Own Radio. This is part two of our interview with Chris Sonnenberg. He's a Disney animator, and he is a friend of mine. So it's been really cool to kind of have him tell his story of where he started and then how he got to Disney Animation. And now we're going to actually get to that part in our interview of when he got to Disney, what he felt about all the different situations that were going on, the actual phasing out of hand-drawn animation, and how he felt about the coming in of the whole digital aspect of animation in Disney features. So it's just fantastic, all the little stories that we tell along the way. I ask some pretty in-depth questions, and he answers the questions for me. And actually, he left Disney, and he's going to talk about what he's doing right now. And it's just exciting things, and he's just a great guy and has a lot of information, a lot of great stories to tell. So without any further ado, here we go. We return to our interview with Chris Sonnenberg here on Roni's Own Radio. Okay, tell me the story of how you were hired at Disney.
A lot of it goes back to just a lot of really amazing, great timing. And just I was just lucked out. It just happened to be, I'll tell you what happened was, I was working on a movie called The Swan Princess at a company called Rich Animation in Burbank, downtown Burbank.
Richard Rich, right?
Yeah, Rick Rich, or Rich Rich. And we were working on that. It was my first feature, and there was all this talk about his next feature, and we're all going to go on to it, and everything was, you know, coming up roses, and it wasn't the greatest movie in the world, but we were like, you know, we'll get him next time, and we're going to make this thing really good and everything. And I'm trying to think of the actual things that kind of went down. And they were working on, The Lion King had just come out, and we were on The Swan Princess, and The Lion King, they did a re-release of The Lion King like 3 months after it had come out, right when The Swan Princess came out. And The Swan Princess was going to have its own release date, and then Disney decided they were going to re-release The Lion King and just killed The Swan Princess. I mean, just killed it. And so, I mean, here it is, the largest money-making animated feature of all time at that time, and here's this little Swan Princess movie. So it wasn't looking good, and so I went and I went and had lunch at the studio with a buddy of mine who was there, and I was just, I mean, of course I loved Disney, and of course that's everybody's dream to be there and everything, but I wasn't quite prepared for the amount of inspiration that I would get when I walked in the door there.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously they didn't have the building that they have now at that time. We were working at a small little, basically little storage buildings down in Glendale. And I walked in, and actually we had lunch at the Imagineering building down off of Flower, and when I walked in, I was just like, I just got like blood in my eyes, and I was like, I need to be here. Someone needs to get me here. I don't know what I got to do, but all roads lead to this building. It was like, they had like a Dumbo sitting in the corner, and they had like a little mock-up of Space Mountain, and just everything that you think of was at this building. And I had never been in any of the official buildings really, and I had walked in, and I was like, okay, I am home, you know? So I found a guy that, you know, so after Lion King did so well, they were like, well, we got to make 10 of these a year. You know, we got to do a lot of this. So there was this huge influx of hiring at that time, and I was lucky enough to be in that wing, and I went downtown and took what was called a cleanup test, and you tested, you went in, and it was, I think it took like 6 hours or something, and I just sat down and took Pocahontas drawings and traced them and made, you know, that was what I did at the time, was called cleanup. Mm-hmm. And I guess I did well enough to be hired. And when I got on for the last part of Pocahontas, it was the last real push for Pocahontas, I just worked my tail off, basically. Yeah. I mean, I didn't have a girlfriend, I didn't have a wife, I didn't have any kids, I didn't mm-hmm. have really a life, and my only passion in the planet was Pocahontas at the time. So right. me and about four other guys basically lived at our desks. We bought beds, we bought little cots, put them in our cubicles, mm-hmm. basically lived there for about 3 months.
Yeah.
And proved to them that we were hard workers and really had the talent to make it. So we got asked to stay on for the next picture. I got asked to work at that point. I got called from the producers of Hercules to ask to work on that, which was in super pre-production at the time.
Right.
And then my other buddies got pulled onto Hunchback, and mm-hmm. you know, the rest is history. And, so it was a lot of hard work for a very short amount of time, but it really paid off.
Well, let me kind of run a couple of things together. I have to tell you, the day that you took me through the animation building,
yeah,
and over to the other side where, you know, the other original offices were.
The old animation building. Yeah, yeah.
Was probably one of the top five moments of my life.
Yeah. And I gotta tell you, we still go there. I was just in that building 2 weeks ago for a meeting, and I still, to this day, and I've been there many, many times ever since then. I mean, I used to go there for lunch and just walk. To this day, I still go to that building, and I still get shivers, and I yeah. still get, you know, inspired by those hallowed halls, you know?
Sure. I remember it was almost kind of like, you know, you just said, okay, just be quiet. And right. it was almost like, I don't want anyone to know I'm here.
Right.
I mean, this must be just some big joke.
Right.
That they hired me here. So just keep your mouth shut and just
I
look
don't
around.
Mess this up.
Don't talk to anybody. Just be quiet. And I'm walking up and I'm seeing the Hunchback storyboards on the wall.
Right.
And you said, okay, that's for Hunchback over there. Now let's roll through. Okay, you worked on Pocahontas.
Yeah.
And you animated the dog, if I remember correctly.
I actually did cleanup. Yeah, I did cleanup in between on Percy.
Okay.
I did cleanup in between on Mother Willow. This is you're racking my brain here because it has been a long time. And the raccoon. Mm-hmm. I don't even know, Miko.
Right.
And I did some stuff on Flit. It was all just cleanup stuff at the time. Right. Again, we were just rushing to get it done. Mm-hmm. So you kind of did whatever came across your desk. And so I just did like three drawings of the bird, and then it would be done. And I did like 10 drawings of the tree, and then that would be gone. And then I get, you know, 42 drawings of the guy pushing a boat, and that was that. And, mm-hmm. you know, it was just kind of like touch. It was just like, again, it was like guerrilla animation making. It was just like whatever had to get done.
Right.
Get it done, you know, and I think at the end of the day, the stuff I did the most of was Percy. Yeah, yeah, I think it's right towards the end there.
Now, so they would hand you kind of spot drawings of a full movement, and you would fill in between, right?
Yeah, that's a lot of times, typically, and I say typically now that, you know, things are kind of changing, but typically back then, you're a starting position, a starting entry level kind of position at the studio would be cleanup. You know, if you wanted to be an animator, you typically started in, if you wanted to be a background painter or a layout, you started somewhere else. But to be an animator, to really get to know what you're doing, they would normally start you in cleanup. So that's where I started, and I did cleanup on Pocahontas, and mm-hmm. I was fairly good at it. The trick at Disney at the time was to not be too good at something, because if you were too good at it, then that's what they would keep you there.
Okay.
So I was fairly good at it, but I knew not to get too good at it, because mm-hmm. then I would just be cleanup guy for
right.
forever, and I didn't really want to do that. So, but I enjoyed it, and you know, I got my little bump on my finger doing all the drawings, and I earned that. But it certainly was a badge of honor to make your way through that. It was a completely tedious job, and to anybody else, it means suicide. But I enjoyed it. It is, yeah. You would just get things called keys, which were your main movement points. And on the side of the paper, there would be a thing called a chart, and the chart would tell you, you know, how far apart to draw the drawings. I mean, it sounds so monotonous, but it was actually really, you know, here I was being paid to draw at Walt Disney Feature Animation. And when I wore that, I mean, I had that, you know, the badge in my wallet, and I mean, I couldn't have been on top of the world,
yeah.
You know, even though I was doing stupid cleanup drawings for what turned out to be the Titanic of Disney Feature Animation. But
right.
I mean, who cared? Like, I was there and I was in the building, and, you know, I was going to Disneyland, like, you know, twice a week, and it was just like I was in my element. I had arrived at the place where everybody wants to be. I was sitting
wow.
in the desk where people kill other people to be. You know,
yeah,
like I
yeah.
was there, and I didn't take any second for granted. I loved and drank in every moment.
Wow, wow, man. Okay, so Pocahontas. You worked on...
Then I worked a little bit on Hunchback. Basically,
okay.
I was really fortunate to be able to put my name on a credit for every film from Pocahontas all the way till the end on Home on the Range. Now,
gosh.
I say it till the end, but at the end of that time, that
right.
was going to be the last traditionally animated film. But I worked on every single one. Hunchback, Hercules, Mulan, Tarzan, Fantasia... I don't know, there's the Emperor's New Groove and Home on the Range, everything in between there, all the little shorts. I worked on Runaway Brain. I worked on like Matchstick Girl that just came out with The Little Mermaid. I worked on that. So, yeah, everything that was animated at the studio at the time, I had the pleasure of being able to work on. I was really fortunate.
Wow. Now, let me ask about Emperor's New Groove.
Yeah.
Now, that film in particular changed quite a bit.
Sure, yeah.
Originally, it was a film with Sting doing a title song.
Well, he had actually written the entire, all the songs. It was more like
right.
five or six songs that he wrote for that song, for that film. And it was originally directed by Roger Allers, or co-directed by Roger Allers, who directed The Lion King. And it was called Kingdom of the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big, epic, Incan, like, beautiful movie. Like, it was a gorgeous kind of, like, I don't even really remember the original story for it. But it really went through a lot of changes, and it had a lot of growing pains, and we actually produced a good, I don't want to say half, but at least a quarter of that thing got through animation
right.
before they pulled the plug and changed the entire direction of it. I mean, it was not the slapstick, cartoony gag film that it became. I mean, it originally was a little more serious, a little more... musical, a little more beautiful,
yeah.
a little more serious, and it really became something different. You know,
sure.
The different directors have different visions, and the company that existed at the time chose to go in a different direction.
Right.
You know, love it or leave it, and that's the kind of what happened. You know, and yeah, that was a really interesting film to watch grow from a concept to the screen. And you know, another film that did the exact same thing, a lot of people aren't too aware of, is Home on the Range. Did the same thing. They were working on Home on the Range when I started on Pocahontas.
Wow.
Yeah, when I started on Pocahontas, there were ideas floating around for Home on the Range, and it was actually called Sweating Bullets.
I remember that.
It was about a little cow named Bullets, and it was a calf, and this calf, it was a really great little story. It was about this ghost, and it was supposed to be played by Jim Carrey, and this ghost was hoarding all of the... It was really clever. It was about this ghost who lived in a ghost town, and he was hoarding all of the clouds to keep his ghost town really dark and gloomy. And so all the clouds... And he would go out and wrangle the clouds, and he had this ghost... he had this big ghost horse... And his name was Slim, but you know, it was, the character was still named Slim, but he was slim because he was a skeleton.
Right, right.
So Slim would go out with his skeleton horse and wrang, you know, like wrangle these clouds, and that's what was making the ranch dry up, and she was going to lose her farm. And so this calf had to go, who was really timid and scared, had to go into this ghost town and confront this ghost. And it was really neat. It was really dark and really kind of, it was almost like Haunted Mansion, where it was fun and dark and kind of scary, but you know, it was kind of a really fun roller coaster ride. And then it, you know, and then obviously it became this really goofy cow movie and lost all of its charm and lost all of its spark, you know, everything that it had in the beginning. They just sucked right out of it, and then it just became this sad excuse for a Disney classic, you know.
Well, you knew this question's coming. You can answer it however you like.
Sure.
But you, coming from the age of probably the last resurgence, perhaps, of hand-drawn animation, what is your feelings about the initial changing and releasing of a bunch of hand-drawn animators from Disney, and then this newest turn of kind of inviting him back? What is your thought about the change?
I have a very specific view. I know there are, you know, for every person that you ask this question to, you're probably going to get a different answer to. Right. My, I don't have the gloom and doom kind of answer that I think a lot of people have. There was a film release called Dream On, Silly Dreamer that really took a very. I saw the film. I went to a screening of it, and it was very depressing to me to kind of see the way that people were telling the story of how this all went down. Yeah, it was a tough thing. Mm-hmm. It was very hard to take and very a bitter pill to take. But you got to, a lot of things that people forget, I lived my dream. You know, some people came and stepped on it and broke my toy and everything, but I had the chance to be there and make a difference, and I didn't. I was lazy and kind of just did my job, and I kind of let it go. And you know, the people that were there loved to complain, but I had a wonderful time there, and I will never complain about what happened. I mean, of course, you know, would I like it to have seen it have gone a different way? Of course. Would I have liked to seen Roy step up and be the man and take control of it? Yeah, of course. I would like to. You know, Roy had a. I'm going a little in circles here, but I'll try and go a little slower. Roy Disney had, you know, if you've ever seen the animation building, there's that hat, the big blue sorcerer's hat.
Right.
That was originally Roy Disney's office. And, you know, that was originally built to be his office. And by the time we all moved in, not only was he never there, but nobody was there. And I always thought it was a really interesting thing that here was this big gaudy symbol of magic, which is this big dumb hat on the front of this building.
Right.
And here and it kind of symbolized leadership. Like, of course, you know, Mickey wore it and stuff happened, and you know, you kind of look at it metaphorically that way. But in our case, the metaphor was even stronger because there was nobody sitting in it. There was no leader. There was nobody there to say, this is the company that we're going to be. Like, you know, when Jeffrey Katzenberg left Disney to go to DreamWorks and everything, at least he was there at DreamWorks saying, you know, because I used to visit all my friends. I still do visit my friends over at DreamWorks, and it's a great studio.
Sure.
You will see Jeffrey walking around, and say what you will about the studio. If you don't like Shrek, or you don't like the Over the Hedge, or you don't like whatever it is, you can say that. And know that Jeffrey Katzenberg is responsible. At least he's man enough, or at least he's the type of leader that will take responsibility for what happens at his studio. There was nobody at the studio at Disney at the time that you could say, this is the reason that things are happening.
Right.
There was nobody there to really lead our company and say, this is the direction, this is our legacy. This, and there was nobody there that had a background in animation. I mean, there were a few guys, but I mean, they were being told what to do, and you just kind of did what you were supposed to do. But there was never anybody there that we could say, this is our leader, and this is the guy we're going to follow. There was never anybody in that hat. And so was I surprised when it started falling down? Of course not. I quit before I was allowed to be fired, because we could all see it happening. Yeah. It was definitely was not the studio that I was hired at.
Right.
I was hired at this great place that had tons of future and lots of inspiration and open arms at the research library that had, you could always go down there and grab animation and look at it and be inspired by the legacy of the past. And when I quit, it was just a shell of a place.
Right.
I mean, it was just not, it wasn't that, it didn't have that heart. There wasn't a leader. There wasn't a future. If they had a future, it was really confused and they weren't, you know, I always say that the reason I loved Disney feature animation is because they were at the front of what everybody was doing.
Yeah.
You know, Walt was at the front of the freaking line. You know
right,
what I mean?
Right.
Like, everybody wanted to be like Walt Disney.
Mm-hmm.
And when I left that company, Walt Disney Studios and Walt Disney, specifically Walt Disney Feature Animation, was just this lame imitation of 10 other studios that sucked.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And here they are trying to be like Pixar. And here they are trying to be like DreamWorks. And it just was embarrassing. It was embarrassing to wear, you know, that wallet that I had, that really awesome, you know, my badge and my stuff that I was so proud of, started to become an embarrassment. Like, yeah, I worked on Hercules, and I worked on, and you know, it's these films that have no legacy whatsoever. Like, I went there to create the next, you know, Peter Pan,
right?
And we were making a laughingstock imitation of a sequel to the worst movie ever made. You know, like, we were a shell of what we could have been. And so to say that I'm bitter about it, I'm not bitter about
yeah.
it. I think we all kind of knew what was going to happen, and so I quit at the time. Now, there is a resurgence. I mean, I know you're probably going to get into this, but yeah, there is a resurgence, and hopefully the people that are in place this time will be able to learn from the mistakes of the recent past and fix that and get the right people in place that can have a direction. I always say that the reason that Pixar has been so successful is because John Lasseter is at the front of that line, and
right.
people want to be like him, and people want to follow his direction, whatever that is. Again, like, you know, say what you will about Jeffrey Katzenberg, but at least he's the guy that you can go to and say, this movie was good or this movie was bad. There's the reason.
But yeah, I hope the future brings something good. Was it Eisner? I have no idea, you know. But maybe, you know, with Iger and the new setup, you know, maybe there's enough people that remember. You know, that was the thing. I remember talking to my teacher, and he said that after Walt died, there was two factions in Disney. There were the let's do it like Walt, and then there was let's do it our way.
Right.
And so I hope maybe we're going back to let's do quality animation.
Yeah.
Okay, let's kind of shift a little bit here. Now, you have some buddies at Lucasfilm? ILM?
I've had people, you know, I've had friends that kind of have come in and out of that studio. You know, like I said, Gendy was working on the Clone Wars, the animated show, and I've had friends that have been animators there. I don't have anybody that I know right now that are entrenched in anything. I wish I did, but I don't have anybody that I know right now that are one of the main talents there.
Now, you mentioned something about Casper.
Oh, yeah, sure.
That Casper originally was done, and the animation was not up to par.
Yeah.
And so they changed all that. And were you involved in that, or were you just telling me that it was redone with ILM's help or something?
That rings a bell to me. I don't exactly remember what happened, but I do remember I did have some friends that went from Disney up there to work on the original Casper film, and I do remember them having some issues with some of their animation and needing some traditional animators to kind of come in. And I think you know, the beginnings of computer animation were really rough because a lot of the people that were computer animators were people that wrote the programs for it. They were programmers.
Yeah.
You know, they were guys that really loved computer programming, and they knew how to work the software, and they knew how to press the buttons and move the mouse around and make things happen, but they weren't instinctually performers, animation performers, animators, you know, like you know, traditional animators. And so there has definitely been this growth, this growing pain in computer animation, where there is still becoming this generation of animators who start their career as computer animators. Now, at the time when Casper came out, they really had this tough time finding animators that could not only could perform well, but could also work the computer.
Sure.
And I know that they had a hard time finding people that could do that. And I knew a couple guys that went up there and actually helped out with that. But that's all I kind of remember about that. But the bigger picture being that there is this learning curve of traditional animation to computer animation. You can teach someone how to work Microsoft Office. They can teach someone an interface, but you can't really teach someone how to be a great performer. In other words, they either got it or they don't.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And so all that to say that the better computer animators come from, I would say, this is a very general term, and I will, you know, obviously there are exceptions to the rule, but typically the better computer animators come from a traditional background in that, you know, the best guys that pick up that mouse have done 5 or 6 years of some of the really great hand-drawn animation.
Mm-hmm. What is Living in Walter's World?
And it was about a guy who basically lived in his own mind, lived in his own television show in his head, and I worked on, a guy came to me and had a very specific idea of what he wanted the opening titles to his short to be, and it was called Living in Walter's World, or Walter's World, and I did the opening credits for that, and it was a really fun thing. I had never really done titles or designed titles before, but it was very much like some of the old Billy Wilder kind of openings, where, like, you know, the fun little moving stick figures, kind of like, be humble to say, in the tradition of, like, you know, Catch Me If You Can, those old kind of 60s kind of thing. It had that kind of feel to it. And it was about 40 seconds of not even that, maybe 30 seconds of animation for the opening of a live-action short. So it was really fun.
Tell me about your new digs, James Baxter Animation.
Well,
okay,
to say James Baxter Animation,
okay,
say James Baxter, I hope people that are listening to this, no, James Baxter is just basically, at the end of the day, in about 50 years, will be looked back on as probably the greatest person to ever pick up a pencil.
Okay.
To actually ever animate. He worked on characters like Quasimodo. He did Rafiki. He animated Belle from Beauty and the Beast. Some stuff on Roger Rabbit. He animated Spirit from DreamWorks.
Wow.
Spirit, Stellan and the Cimarron. He's just one of the greatest technical animators, as well as one of our greatest performers who've ever animated. And I met James when I was on Hunchback. I got to work with him on one of the first scenes of the film that I actually got to work on, was the scene at the end of Hunchback where he, you know, Quasimodo is taking Esmeralda to the top of the cathedral there, and lifts her up above his head, the big camera crane move, you know, and technically unbelievable from an animation standpoint. And so I remember when I got to work on that, I got to meet him, and it was just like meeting a celebrity, and it was really fun to actually work with him. And then we stayed in contact for many years, and we saw each other maybe at parties or whatever. And then finally, I worked with him a little bit on Sinbad at DreamWorks when I was at DreamWorks. And I got to work with him there, and then shortly after that, he worked on Shrek 2, and then Madagascar, and then right after he left Madagascar, he left the studios to create his own studio because he was not happy with working on the computer and wanted to start his own animation studio. So he put his money where his mouth is. A lot of people complain about it but don't do anything about it. James actually decided that he was done seeing people break his toy and opened his own shop. So he opened up a shop in Pasadena, downtown Old Town Pasadena, California.
Yeah,
I started there about a year and a half ago, almost. Yeah, a year and a half ago. And I've been there ever since. The first couple of things we worked on were some commercials. We did a little bit of stuff for Curious George.
Okay.
It's just an amazing place to work. We have desks. We're a hand-drawn animation studio. We are committed to doing hand-drawn. I mean, of course, we could probably do computer animation if we wanted to, but because James's passion is hand-drawn, that's what we do. We do hand-drawn animation the best way it can be done.
Yeah. You're a heart guy. You do things for the passion of your heart.
Course.
That's cool. And you gravitate around to people that feel the same way.
Why do anything for? Why do stuff for any other reason?
True. Now you're working on some things you really can't talk much about, but you are at work on some new projects.
We're working on. I mean, it's no secret that we're working on Enchanted for Disney. Enchanted is a live action feature.
Okay.
And for Disney, that will be out at Thanksgiving 2007.
Okay.
And it's a live-action feature that has a little bit of animation in the beginning, and that's what we're working on right now. I'm actually James's assistant director of animation on that.
Wow.
So that's what my credit will be on this film. And it's basically, when it comes out, will be, I mean, anything less than the best animation that's been done in the last 30 to 40 years.
Now, you also are involved with Conduct Happiness?
Yeah, that's a little company that a buddy of mine from Disney, Joe Mosier, who is a character designer at Disney Feature, who's still there, and I went to school together at CalArts, and through the years, have always joked around about starting our own business and kind of joked around about doing something, and we finally got so sick of him getting sick of taking orders at Disney and me kind of just doing other people's stuff, we decided that we wanted to do our own thing. And so we got together one foggy evening and decided that what we wanted to do was children's clothes. So we put together Conduct Happiness. It's a children's clothes company that is central out of Tarzana, California. We have a base there, and we distribute children's clothes. We just do little fun designs. You can go to conducthappiness.com and check them out. But it's just it's a little release, basically. It's a little chance for Joe and I to kind of get together and do our own funny designs, and we have complete control over everything, and it's fun. It's a really great opportunity. And a little release, a little creative release. We were at the Comic-Con this year, and
we had
a really great response from everybody. So it's fun. It's a fun hobby / business venture.
Yeah. Now that kind of brings me into another little subject, is designing children's clothes. It's a little easy for you because you have some children of your own. Tell me about your wife and your family.
I have a wonderful family. Well, living out in Valencia, I met a girl who went to the master's college out here, the local Christian college, and her name was Janelle, and we met and got married, and we've been married for 10 years, and we have two lovely daughters, Catalina, who is 4, and Ariana, who is 6, and they're just little firecrackers. My daughter, last year, was Star Wars year for Halloween. My Catalina, my 4-year-old, was Chewbacca. And Ariana was Princess Leia, and they all got all dolled up, and we went out trick-or-treating last year. So they're my little Star Wars fans.
I see.
Yeah.
And how do you juggle a very busy career, a little business on the side, plus a marriage and a family?
You know, I was thinking about that. It really kind of comes down to your support system. I mean, I couldn't do it without a wife who works so hard to kind of she does all the back end stuff in the family. Like, she takes care of the kids and she rushes them off to school and she, you know, writes the checks and does all the back end stuff, and I do all the front end stuff where I'm at the office, and you know, I do the disciplining and I help with the homework and all the fun stuff. But I don't think that I could do anything that I do at all without her support and without her there next to me helping me get through day by day. She's just really the reason to get up in the morning and the reason to come home at night. I mean, without that support system, it's hard to do anything, to get anything off the ground. And so how do I juggle it? It's tough. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say that it's an easy thing. It's really tough. We have our hard days. She has her hard times where she wishes I was home with her and putting the kids down. And I have those days where I wish I could be home. It's a struggle. It's not an easy thing, but we do it and we get through it. And we have a great relationship because of it. It is that. I mean, you say I'm a hard guy, but you know, it doesn't end with my animation. I bring that passion into my family and my kids. They get that sense from me as well, and we do a lot of things with everything that we are. Like we play real hard, and we rest real hard, and we work real hard, and it's fun.
Men are dreamers, and they cannot, in my estimation, they cannot fulfill their dream completely without someone to cheerlead.
Yeah,
and when a man is a dreamer, he needs a woman who will cheerlead for him to get all the way.
Of course.
And you have found one, and I've found one, and it's really an amazing, amazing thing to really come home when times are tough and you just feel like giving up.
Sure.
And, you know, your wife kind of looks at you and says, you know, you can do it.
Yeah.
You can do it. And it's just incredible. And you have two little ones too that you kind of look at and you go, you know, I probably dreamed of this when I was their age. So, you know, I want to pass that along to them.
You know, it was really fun. I had the opportunity to take Ariana down to see the Star Wars line. I waited in line for Star Wars at the Chinese theater, and it was so fun to be able to take her down there and see her. You know, she went down there in her Jawa costume. She was a Jawa one year for you can see a little running theme in my family, but in her little Jawa costume. But to see her have the same, and she loves it. It's not like, you know, these were not my decisions. These were all definitely on their own. But but to see her get excited and kind of have the same little experiences and fun little things, it is really inspiring, and it gets me going too. When we went to a parent night, something at a school thing function one night, and all the kids got to go up and say what they wanted to be when they grew up, and all the kids were saying, like, I want to be a soccer player, and I want to be a, you know, I want to be a baseball player, I want to be a firefighter. And then my daughter was the only one that got up there and said, I want to be an artist just like my dad.
Wow.
And that's just like, what do you do? Like,
yeah,
that's what it's all about. And then, I look around and I throw my arms up and I'm like, I'm done. I just want to be done. Like, it can't get any better than this. I know it's all going to be downhill. She's going to be turn out to be some rotten egg. But just at that moment, that little Polaroid moment was like, that's what it all comes down to, you know?
You don't seem jaded at all from working in what everyone would consider maybe Hollywood or the biz. You don't seem jaded.
Well, we're going to end this section right here, and I just listened to this again, and there's so much in this interview. I just thank Chris for taking his time to kind of go over things that it taxed his brain to think back, but I really appreciate his time, and it's just a fascinating look at all the different facets of having family life and working at Disney and starting your own company and all the different parts, how they work together. But before we go, I do want to mention the fact that Roni's Own Productions and our base is at jrdonline.com. We have a lot of different shows. And another show that we have is Ear Giggles. It's a comedy show with a lot of freshly written parodies and parodies that you can get no other place. And it's just a great way to just kind of yuck it up and write some funny stuff and get it out there. So that's also at jrdonline.com. You can also find it on iTunes. And there is one other show that we've closed production on, but we are now releasing all the old episodes, and that's Tatooine TV. That was the original Star Wars and Icons from Today parody show. It's an award-winning parody show, as is Roni's Own Radio. And Tatooine TV was kind of the first step into the whole parody comedy, written specifically for Tatooine TV, recorded by some great people. And it's just really, really funny stuff. And so Tatooine TV is also available at jrdonline.com. Again, as I said, we're releasing all the old episodes. It's also available on iTunes, and so you can check that out as well. There's a lot of really great shows coming in the future on Roni's Own Radio. We're going to have some fitness topics and some travel topics and some just fantastic stuff. So if you're not subscribed, please subscribe. And if you are, tell some people about it, because it's just picking up steam now, and we're happy to be here, and we're happy to be sharing some really cool stuff with you. So anyway, thanks so much for listening. Thanks for listening to Roni's Own Radio. Please visit our website at jrdonline.com and send us some feedback at jeff.roni@gmail.com. Until next time, this is Jeff Roni saying, see you later. Bye. Roni's Own Radio is a Roni's Own audio production.